Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Good to have you here with us. If you're listening in real time, it is Friday morning at 9:05, basically. Good morning, everybody. What a week in Georgia politics, not to mention national politics. It's been extraordinary. We have a great panel here that can help break down for us everything that's been going on this week and more. Starting with Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper, and he oversees the political insider blog on AJC.com, except for on Fridays when you have to get up extra early to make your way down here from somewhere in the far reaches of Cobb County.
On a rainy day, thank goodness for the Tuller Coaster.
Thanks for being here, Jim. We're going to talk in a few minutes about a column that you will post on your, is it posted at this point?
It'll be posted later today in a couple hours.
And if you don't like reading things on the internet, it'll be in the Sunday AJC. We'll talk about it shortly. Next to you, State Senator Elaine Parent, a Democrat from DeKalb County. I'm not sure I've ever said when introducing you on this show, it's been a while since you've been on, you're my state senator.
That's right.
Elaine Parent.
Very proud to be.
Welcome. I have a few issues I'd like to discuss with you later.
All right.
No, I don't really.
Get in line.
I don't actually. Patricia Murphy is back with us. Patricia Murphy's worked both sides of politics. She worked with Senator Sam Nunn. She worked with Senator Max Cleland on Capitol Hill. She is a journalist now. She writes a column that appears in Roll Call. She writes occasion, not as much for the Daily Beast these days, I don't think.
Not as much, but I think we may be ramping up. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I guess
a lot to write about.
I guess there is. Mm-hmm. And you write for Garden and Gun, which is the real, the whipped cream.
Don't I know it.
The
tasty
you
treat.
You talked to me about an interesting piece for Garden and Gun, because it's cultural stuff, about, tell us what it's about.
Well, this is still...
Can we talk about it?
Well, it's a pitch, so it hasn't gone anywhere yet. So
right.
I'm going to respectfully decline until,
I sign my contract. Okay, I didn't realize that. All right. And Eric Tanenblatt is with us. Eric Tanenblatt, I think one of the most influential Georgia Republicans. He's worked with presidential candidates going back to George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, when Jeb was in the race for president early on in 2016. You were with the Jeb Bush folks. Mitt Romney is someone you've spent a lot of time working with. Eric has been one of the biggest bundlers in the South for quite a long time, but also somebody who gives advice to these candidates. And we could take you back to Paul Coverdale in the state Senate. You've had a long history.
Sonny Perdue,
former chief of staff for Sonny Perdue. So welcome. Glad to have you back with us.
Glad to be here.
Jim, let's get started. We spent a couple of days, as did most journalists, talking about the fact that there was this interesting clash going on in the legislature at a bill, HB, House Bill 757, which would have changed the way in which Georgians would have voted for what we're calling Senate seat number two, the seat now occupied by Kelly Loeffler. As we know, that election was going to put Democrats and Republicans alike on the same ballot. And that's the way it stands right now.
In November.
Right. A special election on the same day as we'll have the regular election in November. 757 would have changed that. 757 would have called for primaries for both Democrats and Republicans in May. We thought David Ralston and other Republican leaders, especially in the House, were pushing for that because we thought that was a way to give Doug Collins some advantages over Kelly Loeffler. All of a sudden, the air went out of that balloon like in a heartbeat.
Right, right.
What's going on with that?
Doug Collins enters the race on a Wednesday. On Thursday morning, HB 757 went to the House Rules Committee, and in 2 minutes, it was withdrawn and remanded back to the House Governmental Affairs Committee. What you have to presume, this was a move that had been supported both by Democrats and Republicans. Democrats thought it might help Raphael Warnock get through a Democratic primary easier. He announced on Thursday. Of course, the governor had threatened a veto, and what we have to interpret, we have to interpret that that withdrawal as a kind of a signal that there was not a support for a majority of the Republican caucus, and so Ralston and or whoever was pushing this didn't want to be seen as just allying with a minority of Republicans and with Democrats. That would have been poor politics in the state capitol.
Yeah, Patricia, it's a little, there's a lot to unpack, but to just walk it through it a bit. The presumption was that Doug Collins has going to have the backing of people like David Ralston in the state house. A May primary probably would have worked to his advantage because it would have come up sooner. It wouldn't have given Kelly Loeffler as much time to make sure people knew who she was. This was the thinking, at least. And as Jim points out, on the Democratic side, there was some Democrats supported it because they think they would have had a unity candidate, probably Raphael Warnock. All right. All that said, this put Kemp against Ralston, just one more of the battles. They're going to fight over the budget already. And it looks like Kemp won round one on this thing by this bill suddenly disappearing.
Well, it was a knockout in the first round, I think you'd have to say. It was, I think, in the first place, extraordinary that this popped out of the Governmental Affairs Committee so quickly. An original, more vanilla election reform bill had been introduced, and then there was a substitute popped in there really quickly that would have moved the jungle primary, which is such a huge it's just an important race. It's something that everybody's talking about. The Kelly Loeffler appointment has been controversial in some circles. And the fact that legislators would address it so quickly in a way that I think would have clearly helped Doug Collins, to me, was looking like a little palace coup coming out against Kemp and the White House.
Yeah.
But I think that Jim really hit the nail on the head. If you're not going to, you cannot take that vote if you're not going to win.
Why against the White House, too, since the White House has certainly not weighed in on whether they prefer Loeffler over Collins, and some think the White House may prefer Collins.
I think so, but I think also the president has been very supportive of Loeffler in the days since that she's been appointed, gone out of his way to tweet about her, to say, Kelly, you're doing a great job. Thanks for being here. I think he's starting to put his weight, at least publicly, behind Loeffler.
Oh, okay.
I also think taking the personalities out of it, and I know we all like to talk about the palace intrigue, I think the bigger issue, too, is you're in the middle of an election, and don't change the rules in the middle of the election. And, you know, having been around politics for 30 years here in this state, every time we tinker with the election law, it always backfires.
Yeah.
You know, people have intention. Well, they have these intentions.
So that's the advice you'd send perhaps to the Secretary of State, who instead of following state statute and holding qualifying for Senate seat number 2 60 days before that election, wants to have qualifying for everything in May, don't tinker with it?
I don't know. That's up for people like Elena to decide.
Well, let me get to Elena first, Jim. Senator, one of the other things I think that may have been on the minds of Republicans in the House was there was great uncertainty. Even if they had been able to come up with a veto-proof majority in the House on this bill, there were a lot of questions as to whether your body, the Senate, would have gone along. And I don't think they wanted to risk losing there as well. Do you think that's true?
I think that the Lieutenant Governor, Jeff Duncan, so far this session, as some of these battles have unfolded, gives the indication more that he's on Team Kemp. So therefore, I don't really think that this legislation would have come up in the Senate. And so I was wondering if the pullback meant more that this had been a little bit of a flare or, you know, sort of a jujitsu move by the speaker, you know, to show Kemp, listen, I have a lot of power here. And there's a warning sign, but we're not actually going to do it right now.
Jim?
Two things. Number one, I think Elena's right. I think it sets up a talking point. Legislative debate has pretty much ended. Now the rhetorical debate on the campaign trail becomes who should pick the Republican nominee? Should it be the GOP base, or should it be these 4 million voters? Democrats, Republicans, and Independents in November. That's kind of where Collins is heading. The one precedent I would note, the most direct precedent we have for this is Jimmy Carter was elected governor in 1970. Almost as soon as he was inaugurated, Richard B. Russell died. Mm-hmm. Senator Russell died. Okay, and Carter quickly appointed David Gambrell to replace him. And of course, we all know the story. It was kind of a jungle Democratic primary, and Sam Nunn came up and beat him. Okay, and the difference was. Difference then was that as soon as Jimmy Carter was sworn into office, he became a lame duck. Yeah. Governors were restricted to one term at that point, so there was less danger in confronting a governor over a key appointment like this.
You know, Eric, you made the point a couple minutes ago. Essentially, what you said is this stuff about whether it's a primary or whether it's a jungle primary is inside baseball, essentially, is what you said. And I wonder if that's not true. I wonder if voters, you know, we've heard this argument that kind of argued passionately by the people who want the primary. No, the parties deserve an opportunity to select their candidate in a primary. Do voters care about? I mean, I get that matters to those people who are active in the party, but I don't think voters care when they vote as long as they get the chance to vote. Do you think I'm wrong?
No, I think you're right. And I mean, the people around this table, your listeners and the people down at the General Assembly have been following all of this. But to the average Georgian, they probably don't know what happened this week.
Yeah.
And they probably
won't. Well, if they listen to this show, which they do. They know well what happened. Patricia, you know what I'm saying, though? I mean, I don't think this resonates to say, oh, the Republican Party, oh, the Democratic Party deserves to pick its... No, you agree with that?
No, I completely agree with you. I don't think it resonates, and I think there are very good arguments to be made that the primary system is problematic as far as the ability to govern the country, reach consensus, and that a jungle primary is a far better way to go because people can get their votes from everywhere.
Patricia, that is the first time this week that someone has suggested they like the jungle primary more than primary, which I think is fascinating.
Well, I do, but I think I actually agree because voters would like to, I think, make some decisions outside of these constrictions that say you can vote for this person at this time and that person at that time, but if this person doesn't get through the primary in the first place, then you can't vote for them in the general election. I think they'd like to say, you know, like a buffet. They would like to choose what they like off of the buffet.
Not to mention the limited number of voters that come out for primaries, which are not reflective of the general election population, which is one of the reasons I think the jungle can more accurately reflect the broad spectrum of voters.
But what this discussion is demonstrating is that this requires discussion.
Yeah.
And so form a study committee, have meetings about it, but don't in the middle of an election change the rules.
And that's what's going to happen now. I think but because there is sentiment on the Republican side. The Senate passed a bill 2 years ago in 2018. Sponsored by Josh McCune, that would have done away with jungle primaries in state legislative races.
They were just bitter about Jen Jordan winning
of course they
the
were.
Election.
Yes, they were. Yeah, it was a reaction. It was a reaction. But what I'm hearing about HB 757 now is that it will have a they'll put more study into it, and it will have a January 1st, 2021 effective date.
Interesting. To perhaps outlaw elections that are based on jungle primary elections.
Right.
Jim, you have not been here since we got the news that Raphael Warnock had announced officially. Everybody expected it to happen. It finally did yesterday morning. Neither have any of the rest of you and I. I really want to give you all a chance to weigh in. And Jim, you've got some, I think, insightful ideas about it based on what you've been writing.
Well, it's what's interesting. Number one, it clearly shows that Stacey Abrams is the dominant influencer in the Georgia Democratic
Party. She was very involved in getting him
right.
to finally say, "I'll run."
Right. Yeah. Okay. And let's take a look who's already in the race. You have Matt Lieberman, of course, who's Joe Lieberman's son, the former senator from Connecticut. You also have Ed Tarver, a federal prosecutor. Former federal prosecutor from Augusta. He's an African American. Okay, he is more of a centrist. Okay, and we've on this show we've had Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County, another centrist who kind of pitches toward the middle.
Yeah.
All right. In Warnock, you don't have that. This is. Warnock is a motivator in the mold of Stacey Abrams. He is there to turn out that base. And so you know, what's odd about this Senate race that's forming is that okay, Collins is kind of that same mold. He's a base candidate. Brian Kemp and Kelly Loeffler are the only ones who believe in the middle right now.
Explain what that means to you.
Well, I mean that they're the ones. You know, there's the formula in the South forever has been, you know, Republicans go right, Democrats go left. In November, you converge on the middle and you try to pick up the independents. You've got movements in both parties now that say that that's not the way things work.
I don't really see a lot of evidence that Kelly Loeffler is in the middle right now. I think rhetorically, since she was appointed, she has literally said, I'm pro-wall, pro-Trump, pro-Second Amendment, pro-life. And I've been surprised at her not talking more about business issues. And I'm sure that time will come.
But that's the influence of Doug Collins.
Right. Yes. She's trying to keep him out. But it was very unfortunate for her that, you know, the reason for her appointment is, let's see if we can appeal to some of these women in particular, business-minded, fairly affluent, that the Republican Party has bled in the Trump era. And she has to come out and say all this stuff that's counter to the message that really would have been productive for her. And meanwhile, she didn't even sound like she believed it that much herself.
Yeah.
It just, you know,
she's
the whole thing wasn't so good.
Well, she is not speaking the language that suburban women in Atlanta speak. It's a different tone. It's a different approach. It's just not.
No,
that is not going to resonate unless
not
she changes quickly.
Not at all.
Let me just chime in here. So first of all, to your point, Jim, I do think you have these candidates that are appealing to the base. But to your point about Brian, the Governor Kemp and Kelly being more towards the middle, I don't view it that they're just more towards the middle. I think they just have broader appeal. I think they also appeal to the base. But they also have broader appeal that they can appeal to independent voters as well. Now, with regards to Senator Loeffler, I think we need to cut her some slack. I mean, she just got appointed and she went right into this impeachment trial where for 2 weeks she's had to sit inside the United States Senate. And so all we've seen of her was some of these campaign ads that she's been running, but she doesn't have a voting record yet or an extensive voting record. She has 8 months to really demonstrate where she stands on issues. And I think it's not just it's also style and the way you appeal to people. And, you know, I wrote a piece in James Magazine this month where I talked about it's not always the loudest person who's pounding on the table that defines a person. It's what you do, how you work, how hard you work. And I think you're going to find that Kelly is going to be a hard worker for Georgia. I think she's going to represent Georgia values. And I think you got to give her some time.
There you go.
Well,
where's
I think that's
the campaign spot? Patricia, I think I read it on a Hallmark card somewhere. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression.
Well, you don't get it's harder to redefine yourself than to define yourself.
Yeah.
And she has had videos at the end of every day, or not every day, but I think it's smart to kind of break out of this mold of how you're getting covered in the press and to say how you're feeling and to just let voters hear from you. I think even her approach toward impeachment has calling it an impeachment sham. I don't want to hear witnesses. It's been very much the party line rather than a more nuanced approach.
Well, she also decided to attack pretty vigorously Eric Tannenblatt's friend and former presidential candidate, Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think stunned a lot of people in the United States Senate.
Absolutely.
Jim, Elena.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, no, I agree. I haven't seen any evidence yet of her trying to have a broader message. Instead, it's been counter to, I think, the reasons that she was.
But I think what you're saying, Galloway, is that given that Doug Collins is so closely associated with Trump, has so vigorously defended him, it sort of pushes Kelly Loeffler and Brian Kemp to a place where they can't claim they're line of defense.
I mean, Loeffler is a candidate who was picked in part because of the circumstances of the election, because of this jungle election that we've been talking about. Just to Eric's point, I agree. She's walked into a terribly fraught situation in the Senate where discipline is absolute. So my question here is, you say she's got 8 months to make a name for herself as something slightly different. Where are the areas where we might see her kind of put her own brand on her own candidacy.
Well, I'm not in a position to tell you what issue she's going to take up, and it's up to her. But I think the way she comports herself in the Senate is going to say a lot.
I would guess, Eric, that given that she's a business executive, that it wouldn't be surprising if she sort of follows the David Perdue path to success in the 2016 election.
Well, she's coming to the Senate with a different perspective.
That's my point.
Perdue. Right. And look at the committees that she's serving on. You know, will she carry on some of the work Johnny Isaacson was doing with regards to the VA? She has an ag background. She grew up on a farm. What is she going to do?
I just think it's a little difficult to appoint somebody who's never been elected to anything, who one of the primary criteria appears to have been her wealth. And I just think that turns a lot of people off.
All right. Let me, if you don't mind, we're going to have a lot of time to talk about this. We spent a lot of time on Kelly Loeffler and the Republicans, especially yesterday, of course, Raphael Warnock. Let me change the subject just slightly, if I could. And Jim, this is still developing news. Let's talk about the Senate race in a different way, particularly Senate race number one. Today is the deadline for all candidates in state office, wide offices, to file their fourth quarter financial figures. We've already heard from Ossoff, who told us he'd raised $2 million since getting into this race. You now have the latest figures from David Perdue.
Yeah, $2.5 million this quarter as $8 million in cash on hand.
Yeah. All right.
That's impressive.
A formidable war chest.
Okay. Yes. So here, Elena, is what I think is worth noting today. We have not heard from the other Democratic candidates, the prominent ones. We haven't yet heard from Teresa Tomlinson. We haven't yet heard from Sarah Amico. If they had great numbers, we almost certainly would have heard from them by now. So probably the expectation is they're going to show that they're continuing to find it more difficult to find the money they need. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, I'm not sure if you're...
Yeah, we don't
maybe
know.
Maybe you would have gotten a press release. I might not have. So, but, I mean, I do think that people are still evaluating their choices. I think it can be difficult to break out in an election cycle where you've also got, you know, presidential races and now you have two Senate contests. And so primary donors, active Democrats that do want to support the candidate, are evaluating to see who they think really is going to emerge very strong. And that might mean that they're holding the purse strings a little closer still.
Patricia,
right now.
Ossoff released his numbers weeks ago.
Yeah, I would love to see a breakdown of where his money is coming from.
Yeah.
He has this enormous grassroots network through Act Blue that he was able to build during that special primary election. It's probably the most valuable thing he got coming out of there was this national name ID and the ability to go on MSNBC in prime time to talk about what he's doing. That is just so hard to replicate as a traditional candidate like somebody like Teresa Tomlinson. I don't know a lot about her fundraising operation, but I believe, like most candidates, it's that call time, just the call after call after call, and just every dollar is a battle.
Yeah.
And Ossoff has a really different funding model that will benefit him. It won't make the difference, but it's going to help a lot.
And how much of that $2 million is money raised this quarter or cash on hand money that he had that he transferred over?
I believe most of it's raised since he announced getting in the race.
I believe the way they framed that, and I'll look it up or somebody can look it up for us, was this is how much they've raised since he got into this race.
So David Perdue has $8 million, you said, cash on hand. How much does John Ossoff have
on hand? We will see that number coming in at some point.
But I think it's going to make it really difficult for people like Teresa Tomlinson and Sarah Riggs and Mikos, you know, with David Perdue having $8 million, who is going to want to invest in those
campaigns? Yeah, in a primary, that it is going to make it difficult. Once you get past the primary, though, I think David Perdue's $8 million becomes less significant because you have two Senate races. You will have the DSCC working Georgia very, very hard.
Well, and the presidential.
Yeah.
I mean,
and the presidential.
Let's not forget, everyone will be paying attention.
It depends on who the Democrats nominate.
I think everyone, all Democrats, will be paying attention to all three of those races.
I got to get to a break, but Patricia said an interesting thing, Jim. She talked about you got to work the phones. Every candidate, you got to set aside phone time to call. Tanblad knows that better than anybody. Quick personal story. In 1988, I was invited to spend a few days with Richard Gephardt when he was running for president. And on the first day of our stop, he went into the office of a congressman in South Florida. I don't remember who the congressman was. And he went into a room. I said, what are you going to do now, Congressman? And he said, I'm going to work the phones. I said, do you mind if I listen in? And he allowed me, without my camera, wow, to go in and sit with him as he made the phone calls, went through the cards from his staff. And I was stunned by it because it suddenly, Jim, I realized it doesn't matter if you're running for city council of Macon, Georgia, or president of the United States. You work those phones. Elena Parent knows that.
Right, and almost every politician finds it distasteful. I've only found one person who really liked it, and that was Roy Barnes.
Yeah, it's easier when you have congressman or senator in front of your name than someone who—
Absolutely. You're going to get some money just— They all just have their list, and they say, all right, and they dole it out. So when you're an incumbent, you're going to have some money coming to you.
All right, we'll watch throughout the day as the Political Insider, AJC.com, release it. We'll see the figures as they come in. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in a moment.
Peter Sagal here. We here at Wait Wait love the Fox Theater in Atlanta and are delighted to be coming back. Join us at the beautiful Fox Theater on Thursday, March 12th. Right now, you can receive your tickets before they go on sale to the public. Here's how.
Go to gpb.org/waitwait. That's gpb.org/waitwait. And thanks.
Support for GPB comes from generous listeners like you. And Columbus's River Center for the Performing Arts presenting the national tour of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats with all new lighting and choreography. Winner of 7 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, February 11th and 12th, rivercenter.org. And Cigna. Cigna is committed to improving the health, well-being, and peace of mind of those they serve along with their communities, just like here in Georgia. Cigna, together all the way. Learn more at cigna.com/take control.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. State Senator Elena Parent, Jim Galloway, Patricia Murphy, Eric Tanenblatt with us in the studio today. Elena, let me ask you about this first, because I'd be interested in your thoughts on this as a state senator. Brad Raffensperger's office announced that they are going to propose a new election rule which would eliminate manual hand recounts of ballots in a contested election. They are going to propose that we simply run the ballots back through the same scanners that counted the votes in the first place. I assume there's going to be some significant pushback.
Well,
voter integrity groups are already questioning
that.
Well,
I mean, a couple of points on this. First of all, this is what I feared and is one of the points I made on our debate last year on HB 316, because you could tell from the language in the bill that they weren't actually serious about requiring true, robust post-election audits, which is sort of part of this same conversation. And also, you know, voters are extremely nervous about the idea that the barcode is the actual vote of record because they can't read it. So then why even have the voter verifiable text? Another point is that if you're just going to simply run barcodes back through the scanners, that's the same as the way we were doing quote unquote recounts under the old machines, where there wasn't really such a thing as a recount because all you did is press go again because there was no paper of record. So if we're going to do it the exact same way, why on earth should Georgia voters feel better about the system that we have set up?
Patricia, it is somewhat surprising in an age when some people are more suspicious than ever about the validity of election results. And maybe we'll hear a really valid reason from Raffensperger's office. I haven't seen that yet, and maybe he has it. But it's surprising that this is a time when you'd think you'd want to do everything to convince people that their votes do count appropriately.
Yeah, and I do think right now you have to go above and beyond what is simply required by law to really give Americans confidence in these election results coming up, because it is just a known fact that there has been election interference by multiple foreign state actors. And there have been multiple attempts and many successful attempts to infiltrate state government systems by foreign actors. And that is continuing to happen. And if you listen to any of these, not Intel hearings, but DOD hearings or open hearings, the intelligence community will tell members of Congress again and again, as recently as last month, there are people trying to infiltrate and influence these elections. So, and Americans hear that information, it's on their minds. And so to not have what is just an easily understandable concept of a hand recount, to leave it all up to technology that may or may not be able to be manipulated in the minds of people. Maybe it's not. Maybe it just can't be manipulated. But for people to not know that there could be a piece of paper and you could just count it and then and that is the backup. I think it's a mistake not to give extra confidence in an era like this.
Bill, you've got these voter suspicions that are kind of well-founded and are being stoked right now by what we're hearing out of national security officials. The other shoe in this thing is the expense issue. Are the county officials who have to pay for all this? Raffensperger's office has to pay for all this, and I think that is. I think that's what this is. This is a contest between voter security and voter confidence in the system and what it actually costs, because hand counted ballots. In a sudden election, that's a very expensive thing.
Well, but it's going to be very few, because it would be very.
But you don't know where those recounts are going to be happening.
By the way, we could have much more cheaply bought hand-marked paper ballots, and apparently it was so important that we buy these electronic things in the first place. The cost was not an issue at that point. But it's only a cost when voters need to feel secure in the where we don't do it.
No, I was just saying I have confidence in the Secretary of State, and I think we owe it to him to explain the rationale behind this. I don't know if it's just budgetary. This is really not a partisan issue, because there are people that question the integrity of elections on both sides. And I think, given that we're about to have new voting machines and people are, wonder if this is all going to work, I think the Secretary of State needs to explain the rationale.
And so far he has not. And the problem for Raffensperger is that he has got statements on the record. We've got him quoted as saying, because we have a human readable ballot and that it drops into a box, we'll be able to do a physical recount. That's the. This rule that they've pitched is directly contradictory.
So here's the ultimate nightmare scenario, Jim. I mean, we could see close elections all up and down the Georgia ballot in November, but the nightmare scenario is if you think about those people who honestly believe that Georgia is the new Ohio in presidential politics, that Ohio's comfortably red, that perhaps Georgia could be in play. An election between President Trump and whoever the Democrat is on that ticket that comes within a hair's breadth of one another, you're talking about not having a hand recount of the ballots and throwing it up in the air completely, the question about who the next president of the United States is, if you buy this notion that Georgia could be a determining factor.
Yeah, and then it goes
to the court.
No chance.
No chance. I thought you were supposed to be saying yes. You want to raise money, for goodness sake. Go ahead.
It is. I mean, this is, and quite frankly, this is where the Abrams camp has been headed since 2018. They have understood that the battlefield is going to be in the courts and is going to be on election and voting issues, on counting ballots.
I'm going to jump around a little bit in the format today and do something very quickly. And I know we've got to get you freed up because you're in session today.
We are in session today. Every day this week. That's right.
Session. So we'll get you out of here in a moment. But Jim, we don't talk about, certainly don't talk about foreign affairs on this show very often. But Jimmy Carter now has weighed in very forcibly on the president's new proposal for peace in the Middle East. Here's what he wrote. If implemented, the plan will doom the only viable solution to this long-running conflict, the two-state solution. And he urged members of the United Nations, quote, to adhere to the UN Security Council resolutions and to reject any unilateral Israeli implementation of the proposals by grabbing more Palestinian land. Now, we're not going to get into a conversation today on all the implications and what the deal is. But the fact that Carter has chosen to speak out so strongly, trying to protect his legacy, is worth our mentioning.
Right. And basically, this Israeli-Palestinian proposal that the Trump administration has put together with Mr. Kushner is, I mean, it is a nail in the coffin of the two-state two-state hopes. I mean, Palestinians agree that that's what it is. Israelis agree that that's what this is.
Yeah.
And that raises all sorts of questions for what the state of Israel will be and what kind of citizenship will be granted to future Palestinians in those boundaries.
Patricia, the president has been willing on occasion to speak out against President Trump, but this was a particularly forceful moment, I think. And given the credentials that he brings to this conversation, I think it will give some people pause at least.
Oh, I certainly think so. And it really is where he left one of his strongest legacies,
yeah,
was in his efforts to forge Middle East peace. And because he has stayed out of politics so assiduously and has spent so much time focusing on sort of less partisan issues, or rather nothing not having to do with the sitting president, I think it's something that people certainly listen to. Within the foreign policy establishment, I think there's a lot of agreement with Carter that this is not seen as a good faith effort at bringing the two sides together, but rather as making a decision in behalf purely of Israel. But President Trump was absolutely clear during his campaign and really every day since that he would be the best friend that Israel ever had. He's been unwavering in his support
Of Netanyahu and
yes,
the Likuds.
Yes, I'm sorry, and Netanyahu in particular, who has also been unwavering in his support of President Trump.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just one of many fissures between these two presidents, but it's something that I think is important to listen to. But Trump has gotten a great deal of support within the Jewish community because of his commitment to Israel, and I think that's certainly not going to change at all.
All right. I want to take up another issue, and again, Elaine, I know you're going to leave in a minute. For people who are fans of George Public Radio, I'm really happy to say that On Second Thought is reemerging on air. It's on Fridays at 11 a.m. It's on Saturday at 7 in the morning. It's on Sundays at 11 a.m. And the reason I mention it now, Elena, is that one of the issues they're taking up on this show this weekend is hate crimes legislation. We had a bill that passed the House last year that would have been the most inclusive hate crimes bill ever, would have included LGBTQ protections, which had always been a stumbling block in the past. The Senate, your body, didn't want to take it up. Is this bill coming back this year? Chuck F. Strachan still trying to get this through?
The legislation is currently sitting in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, which I am a member of, and I'm very supportive of the legislation. It does seem that in particular, inclusion of protection for LGBT Georgians remains a stumbling block. It was a contentious vote in the House, and I am hearing that the legislation may emerge, but it may be amended to make the protection for LGBT people more ambiguous. Or perhaps we won't see it emerge.
Eric, it's interesting. Chuck F. Strachan is a Republican. He's the one who's pushed hardest for this bill. On the Senate side, it's been, unfortunately, the Republicans who have been the ones who haven't wanted to advance it. What is the value at this point in 2020 to have Republicans in the legislature who don't want to include protections for the LGBTQ community? It just strikes me it's contrary to where they want to move in the years ahead.
Yeah, I agree. And Chuck Strachan is one of the younger members of the legislature, and I think some of it is generational. I do believe that this would be, if the legislation passed as in the Senate as passed in the House, would be the first time that LGBT legislation would be in code.
That would be my understanding, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's, creating some challenges.
It's been the problem for the last 15-plus years in efforts to get this thing through.
That's
so
true.
It's going to be interesting to watch it. All right. We're going to take a break. I know you want to rush downtown because
you don't want. I mean, but I have to. You know, my job. But I would love to stay with you guys.
Remind me of what happens on the Senate side. Of course, what's interesting on the House side is that traditionally they lock the House at 10 o'clock, Jim. I mean, you better be in there at your seat, and you better be listening to the devotional, and you're locked in there while that's going on.
And it's the same in the Senate.
Having served in both, I find you to be slightly less constrained.
Yeah.
More by rules of decorum. They don't actually lock the doors, but so we, unlike in the House, I had to, if you were there for roll, that was it.
Yeah.
In the Senate, you can press, since we run the button for the roll call for a minute, you can hit present and leave. And many do. And come back in after
but you
the
never.
You don't want to be saying that on the radio.
Anyone can watch the chamber and see it happen. I'm not revealing any secrets.
Senator Elena Kerr, thank you so much for being with us. Have a great trip. Have a great day downtown.
Thank you.
We'll see you on the show
again. It's been a lot of fun.
Soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill, and to all of you.
While Elena Parent takes her leave, why don't we take our final break of the show? We'll come back. Let's talk a little national politics. We got an Iowa caucus coming up, and impeachment is still in the air. We'll be right back.
GPB is free to all citizens of Georgia.
The country mourns the death of a basketball legend. Iowa braces for a five-way fight, and in Washington, the Senate faces an historic moment.
All you need in this case is the Constitution and your common sense.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
1A is this morning at 10 here on GPB Radio. You can also listen online, streaming at gpbnews.org and on the GPB Radio apps.
Support for GPB comes from you, our listeners.
And Georgia Power, working to make Georgia the best home it can be, from empowering young minds in classrooms to protecting native species in state forests. Learn more at georgiapower.com/community.
And Savannah Philharmonic, presenting a different side of classical music with Modern to Majestic, Saturday, February 8th, 7:30 p.m. at the Johnny Mercer Theater with pre-concert talk at 6:30. Details at savannahphilharmonic.org.
We're back on Political Rewind as we head towards the weekend. Let's... You know what? I would really love, before we talk, we'll talk a little bit about where we stand on impeachment, but big weekend coming up, clearly, the Super Bowl, and we've got dueling $10 million Super Bowl commercials between the president and Michael Bloomberg. We thought it'd be fun for you to see those spots. Let's start with the Bloomberg commercial that you'll see on the Super Bowl on Sunday.
George started playing football when he was 4 years old. He would wake up every Saturday ready for the game. That became our life. He had aspirations about going to the NFL. On a Friday morning, George was shot. George didn't survive. I just kept saying, you cannot tell me that the child that I gave birth to is no longer here. Lives are being lost every day. It is a national crisis. I heard Mike Bloomberg speak. He's been in this fight for so long, he heard mothers crying, so he started fighting. When I heard Mike was stepping into the ring, I thought, now we have a dog in the fight. I know Mike is not afraid of the gun lobby. They're scared of him, and they should be. Mike's fighting for every child because you have a right to live. No one has a right to take your hopes and dreams.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
Jim Galloway, whether you like Mike Bloomberg or not, I think most people agree that his commercials have been extraordinarily well produced. I played that first in part because, sure, it's a Bloomberg spot. This is the kind of commercial that Lucy McBath can take advantage of, too.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Of course, the Bloomberg organization, Everytown USA, was very much behind her in 2018. The other thing I would note is that I believe Mike Bloomberg is going to be opening the only presidential office this weekend in Midtown.
Is it in Midtown?
It's close.
Somewhere.
It's somewhere close.
Yeah, it's somewhere very close. Patricia, we know the Bloomberg strategy. We got Iowa caucuses Monday night. We got New Hampshire a week from Tuesday. We know Bloomberg strategy is I'm not competing in those states. I'm waiting until probably Super Tuesday, really, before he hopes to pick up traction. those commercials are everywhere. Is that strategy going to be effective? It's hard. We don't know. But what do you imagine?
If it could be effective, the only person it really could be effective for is somebody like Mike Bloomberg with absolutely unlimited resources. He is not only he's buying so much airtime, it's making it more expensive for other candidates to buy airtime. He's blacking out the airwaves so that it's hard to pay attention to anything else except the Bloomberg ads. And they're very good. And for a guy who comes off in person as extremely cold and removed, that was a very emotional ad that I think was extremely effective. Yeah.
You know, I've always believed that, you know, you can't adopt the strategy where you ignore the early states like Iowa and New Hampshire, like Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah. Florida.
But this is a different dynamic, both because of Bloomberg's money, but also as it looks right now, it's very possible that Bernie Sanders could win Iowa and could win New Hampshire. And at that point, that changes the whole dynamics because he is not, I don't believe, would be a viable candidate nominee for the Democrats. And I think that that provides an opening for Michael Bloomberg.
I totally agree. It's hard to imagine what it could do to Joe Biden's momentum. Not that he has a ton of momentum, but if to lose the first two states, he would need to blow it out in South Carolina.
If nothing else, his fundraising would suffer dramatically, right?
But then Super Tuesday is just right after the South Carolina primary. Yeah. So he would have very little time to make up for the moment, to really capitalize on that momentum. And I sense Democratic voters getting very, very antsy the stronger Sanders gets.
And remember that on Super Tuesday, the big new state in the mix is California.
Right. Yeah.
And right now, Bernie is leading in California.
Yeah. But it is looking better and better. We were all uncertain whether March 24th was a good date to choose for the Georgia presidential primary. Some thought, well, gee, we're going to be out of the mix, but it's looking more and more like the Democratic contest. It could be closer, but Georgia will still be in
This is going to be very much like the 2016 Republican race.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And the TV stations are going to do great. I want to know if you've asked the Bloomberg campaign for some money to run that ad. That's part of your pledge campaign.
We're public.
Yeah, well, yes, but don't you have Pledge Week sometime coming up here?
The person I'm thinking about who's going to get rich this election cycle, as if he already has it, is Bobby Kahn, who's one of the most respected time buyers in politics. Let's look. Trump apparently is going to have two spots. They're 30-second spots. He's already released one of them, but in typical Trump fashion, he's promising a surprise for the second one. Let's look at the one that he's already let us all see.
America demanded change.
Donald Trump wins the presidency.
And change is what we got. Under President Trump, America is stronger, safer, and more prosperous than ever before.
Best wage growth I think we've seen in almost a decade.
Unemployment rate sinking to a 49-year low.
Unemployment for African Americans fell to a new low.
Unemployment for Hispanics hit an all-time record low.
And ladies and gentlemen, the best is yet to come.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
You know, Jim, when I see that spot, hear that spot, what I think about is Trump's campaign team, they ought to do the kind of clockwork orange thing where you sit down a victim and pop open his eyeball, force him to watch violent video. That was, if you remember, clockwork orange. They should do this with Trump. Pound away at him over and over again what the real talking points are that you could use to get reelected.
Right. Yeah, and a couple points on this. Number one, I found there was very limited use of Trump's own voice in this, which I thought was important. And of course, as you pointed out, it was a big emphasis on the economic portion, which is his strength. I mean, I've said before, this should be a Ronald Reagan Walter Mondale race. It is not because Trump is who he is. The one image that's not in there. There's nothing from the July 4th military parade down the streets of Washington D.C.
Do you think that means something, or are you just
I'm just suggesting that was a huge event that Trump wanted. Gotcha. And of course, you know, there was a lot of video shown on there, and that's not part of his argument that he's making, in this video.
Yeah, I think that's a very effective.
Well, argument. As a Republican, I assume you wish that Trump could be as disciplined as his commercials.
Well, but it's patriotic. It's during the right. Super Bowl. But the thing that I took note of is the very end where it has text. Because one thing that the Trump campaign is doing very effectively is they are collecting so much data. And so they're going to know who their supporters are, and they're going to turn their supporters out. And that's the benefit of being an incumbent running for office, because while the Democrats are trying to figure out who their nominee is going to be, the Republicans are building an infrastructure and a get-out-the-vote operation.
Also, above and beyond that, you know, we talked about Trump's lack of of discipline. It is that lack of discipline that has his strongest base supporters willing to do almost anything for him. And he really is quite a genius at counter-programming. So there's talk about the Iowa caucuses. He was in Iowa last night, and people waited for 30 hours, started lining up 30 hours ahead of time. I can't think of anybody else running for any office of any sort right now who can bring out those kinds of supporters.
Paul McCartney or John Lennon.
Real quick final note on that. Other advertisers, advertising age reports of the Super Bowl, are really concerned about these two political ads because they think it'll take away from the messages they, as companies, want to get across. And so the network has promised what they're going to do is isolate the political spots in separate blocks so that they are not surrounded by commercial, which is a fascinating decision.
But to that point, I mean, typically the Friday before the Super Bowl, we're talking about what are the ads going to be at the Super Bowl,
right.
And the ads we're talking about are the political ads.
That's right. Jim, we're very short on time, but we don't want to leave today's show without mentioning the fact that we learned early this morning that Ann Cox Chambers, a huge force in communications, in diplomacy, in almost every aspect of life you can think about, passed away overnight. She is Cox Communications, Cox Enterprises. You and I didn't really know her. We saw her every now and then.
No, we just lived in her world. and it was a big world. She and Barbara Cox
Kennedy.
They were the daughters of Governor James Cox.
Yeah.
Of Ohio, who was a presidential candidate at one point. FDR was his running mate.
Yeah.
It was the last time we saw FDR walking, actually. They moved down to Georgia. They moved the operation down to Georgia after World War II. You know, they bought the Constitution, they bought the Journal, they merged them. WSB was only recently cut loose from the Cox
family,
Cox
yeah.
stable, and but until last year, Cox was its only owner.
She was a Democrat. She was appointed ambassador to France. She had
Belgium.
Belgium. I'm sorry. She had a home in France. She had a home in. I mean, she lived a full and rich life and died at 100 years old. She was a pretty remarkable person. I used to stand occasionally outside her. I was one of her employees. But when she had presidential candidates, Democrats come to her house for fundraising dinners. We were like, stand outside the door. Maybe you'll get a chance. all right. The other quick story I'll tell about Ann Cox Chambers. When Channel 2 moved into a new building some years ago, it was immediately posted in the day that it happened as a no-smoking building. We were notified that Ann Cox Chambers was going to pay her only visit to that building at one point. And we were told, all of us, that if she lit up a cigarette, you better keep your mouth shut and not tell her it's a non-smoking building. All right, we're just about out of time for today's show. Eric Tannenblatt, thank you so much for being here. Patricia Murphy, we always love having you on the show as well. And Jim Galloway, you'll be back with me on Monday when I think we're going to get a chance to really do a little bit deeper dive into what to expect at the Iowa caucuses.
Absolutely.
Monday night. It's going to be fun. Isn't this the moment that we all love to wait for, Patricia, when finally the voters start to speak?
Yes, and I actually lament some of the candidates who dropped out so soon because I would have loved to see what voters in Iowa would have done with somebody like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris. I would have liked to have seen that, but, you know.
And the impeachment took away from some of the lead up to Iowa
caucus. Yes, it certainly did. I am proud to report for the, third, fourth day in a row, we didn't talk about impeachment once on Political Rewind today. You may think that's a bad thing. Personally, I'm glad we leave that to the others, to CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. But by the time you watch this show, if you're watching on TV, we may know whether we're moving quickly toward a vote to acquit President Trump. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you again on Monday at 9 a.m. Take care, everybody.